Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me all right? Thank you so much for coming. We very much appreciate you all joining us here for our official rollout of our study on the future of the National Guard and the Reserves, a report we've been working on for about a year and a half, and I think many of you we've talked to either during the process of formulating our recommendations or actually during our process of vetting our recommendations with the many stakeholders. First, I want to recognize the members of our core study team going, I guess, from the end of the table. P.T. Henry, who I'm sure many of you know, Michelle Flournoy, who you also know, and Dr. Clark Murdoch, who is the sort of father of our larger Beyond Goldwater Nichols series, of which this study is the third phase of that effort. I also want to recognize a number of key folks in the audience who worked with us, particularly Dave McGinnis and Charlie Horner. And I see a number of our working group members, so thank you so much for coming and seeing how it all came to fruition. We also, as always, had a number of key research assistants working with us, particularly Jake Harrington and Sean Brimley, who are terrific parts of the team. I also wanted to thank Congress and the Department of Defense, particularly PA&E, for their support of the project, as well as the Smith-Richardson Foundation and the McCormick Tribune Foundation. Without their support, we could not have undertaken this effort. This morning, I wanted to talk a little bit about how we actually did the study, what we thought were the key issues, and also then talk about some of our key findings and recommendations. In the interest of time and to give people ample time to ask questions of the study team, I'll really just try and cover the highlights of the recommendations. There's more than 40 recommendations in the report. I'm only going to speak to about 10 of them this morning. So please peruse the report at your leisure. There's actually an appendix at the back that lists all of the recommendations in one handy place so that you don't actually have to read all the chapters, although they are gripping. I can guarantee you that. So, as I said, we started the study about a year and a half ago as part of our Beyond Goldwater Nichols series. And really, our intent was to try and think about what should the reserve component, the National Guard and the Federal Reserves, look like for the 21st century. And we tried to look out about 10 or 15 years to get beyond the FYDP. To conduct our work, the primary sort of engine of our study were three working groups. One focused on roles and missions, another focused on how the RC should be organized, trained, and equipped, and a final working group that PT and Michelle co-chaired looking at social compact issues. And by that, we mean the whole range of compensation and benefits, family support programs, and sort of the implied contract relationship between DOD, reservists, their families, and their employers, which is a key part of the compact. Our working groups came from all walks of life in Washington, think tanks, academia. Many of them were former military officials or former civilian officials in DOD. We had folks from CBO, CRS, GAO. We also were fortunate to have representation from the Chamber of Commerce and the National Governors Association. So we did try and take advantage of both the employer perspective as well as the very important state perspective that really is a crucial part of the reserve component. With that as just a brief introduction about how we went about the study, let me try and walk through quickly some of our major findings and recommendations. A key finding in our roles and missions area was the fact that, in our view, the demand for military forces in the future is likely to remain high. Even if, in our view, the operations, the force levels in Iraq and Afghanistan come down significantly in the next few years, and we believe they will, we still think that compared to pre-9/11 levels, the demand for the military to both conduct operations overseas, to be prepared to respond to unforeseen events overseas, and to be prepared for potentially responding to catastrophic events here at home, all of that, we believe, is going to add up to a lot on the plate of the military. And this is important because it drives, frankly, a number of our other recommendations. Flowing out of that view about what we think the demand for the military is going to be, we, I would say, reaffirm the need to have a reserve component that is multi-mission capable. The national security strategy and the security environment requires that we have a military that not only can take on a lot in terms of quantity of missions, but also has to be able to perform a range of different kinds of missions. And we think the reserve component needs to reflect that breadth of missions and needs to remain flexible. So we are not in favor, for example, of taking one of the reserve components or a piece of the reserve component and saying, you know, you will only focus on one particular type of mission, such as, for example, Homeland Defense. At the same time, we do believe that the reserve component, particularly the Army's reserve components, the reserve and the guard, need to put less emphasis in a relative sense on conventional campaigns and really take up the recommendation in the QDR that there needs to be more focus on irregular warfare, irregular operations, things like reconstruction operations, and there needs to be more focus on homeland defense and civil support. So we would argue for a rebalancing among the spectrum of military missions to have a more even approach across all of those different missions. Another key finding, I think, that was an open question, frankly, when we began our study, but really has sort of evolved over time to become more clear, is the fact that we think what we see today in terms of using the reserve component as part of the operational force is really a fact of life now, that the days of potentially returning to seeing the reserve component only as a strategic reserve are gone, and that really in order to be able to achieve all that we have laid out for ourselves as a nation in our national strategy, the reserve component is fundamental and crucial and will have to work side by side with the active component on a routine basis. And this really is a significant change from the past, a significant departure. And in our view, while that is a mandatory shift, it's a shift that is going to be challenging and has a lot of risks associated with it. And as DOD makes that shift, there's a lot of work to be done to make sure that the transition occurs successfully. Turning to sort of the force structure implications of these findings, in our view, the Army as a whole, but the total Army, needs more combat structure, not less. And I think this flows from our view, one, that the demand for military forces is going to remain high, and reflects the fact, frankly, that we believe that the Army currently is under significant strain, I think, to say the least, and that given that we believe the demand will remain high, in our view, it would help the Army tremendously to create a little more slack in the system. We were in favor of retaining the Army's force structure, at least at the level that was considered through most of the QDR, but that was not ultimately the final QDR amount. We favored retaining 43 active brigade combat teams and 34 Army National Guard combat teams. And frankly, in our view, over the longer term, it would be helpful if the Army were able to expand on the active side modestly, perhaps 4 or 5 brigade combat teams. Again, we think that's important for two reasons. One, to give the Army a little bit of slack so that if it needs to provide more than 18 VCTs on a steady state basis, it can do that, it can meet those requirements without immediately having to break force management policies, meaning the 1-in-3 rotation ratio for the active side and the 1-in-6 rotation ratio for the guard side. We also think, frankly, that additional structure would be useful in terms of hedging against risks if this transition to an operational reserve doesn't go as smoothly as it plans. I mean, for example, if all of the funding isn't there to provide equipment, if the rotation ratios need to be adjusted, if it appears that 3-to-1 and 6-to-1 don't work in terms of recruiting and retention, we think having some additional slack or cushion in the system would be very helpful. looking at the actual transition to the operational reserve, our recommendation here is that the Department of Defense has to resource fully the transition to the Army Force Generation Model and the Army Reserve Expeditionary Force, or that transition is not going to succeed. And here, we think conceptually the rotation models are a very, very positive step, but our concern is that the actual resources to make those models a reality are not yet there. Although DOD has put significant funding in the budget, $21 billion for the Guard and $3.4 billion for the Army Reserve over the FYDP, in our view, from our analysis and talking with the various parties in DOD, we believe there's at least a $13 billion shortfall over that 6-year period that is needed to both reset the Army Guard and Reserve in terms of equipment, to come out from under the legacy of tiered readiness, and to complete the modularity process. And that, frankly, that $13 billion just covers those items I've just outlined. As we understand it, we also have concerns about the training plan in R4Gen and AREF, particularly whether there are actually enough training days in the model to realize this vision of moving to a train, mobilize, deploy model. And as we understand it, the funding for that enhanced training is also not in the budget currently. It's not in the current FITIP plan. And that's of significant concern to us. So in general, you know, we think that there are significant additional resources that need to be invested to make the transition to using the Army Reserve component in particular as part of the operational force. Moving away for a moment from the issue of using the RC as part of the operational force and turning instead to the mission area of Homeland Defense, we had a number of recommendations in this area, and I just want to highlight two of them, but there are at least five or six, I think, in this section of our report. First, we think that DOD has to recognize civil support, and by that I mean responding to the range of events, but particularly catastrophic events. We think DOD needs to recognize that mission as a fundamental mission for the Department of Defense. It's almost 5 years after September 11th, and in our view, DOD really continues to hold this mission at arm's length. I think we believe that if there's another catastrophic event in this country, be it man-made or natural, the president is going to pick up the phone and call the Secretary of Defense, at least for the next 10 years. That's just a reality, and in our view, DOD needs to start planning, programming, and budgeting to reflect this reality so that it can do its job as effectively as possible. And part of that acceptance of the civil support mission would also enable DOD to really flesh out and define what is the role of the reserve component inside of this mission space. In our view, one of our recommendations to try and at least take an interim step while DOD figures out exactly what its role is in this space, we recommend that it would be useful to take the National Guard, which has a tremendous amount of existing infrastructure already, and leverage that to form regional civil support forces. And let me talk a little bit about this. Before I even elaborate on this a little bit, I want to make clear that our study fully is of the view that Homeland Defense and Civil Support is a total force mission. Thinking exclusively in terms of the reserve component, we fully believe that the entire reserve component has a role to play in Homeland Defense and Civil Support. We don't think that this is a mission only for the National Guard. So please don't come away with that impression. We have made this recommendation to create these civil support forces, recognizing a couple things. One, again, the National Guard does have an extensive existing infrastructure, and it has a very special relationship, as you all know, with the state governors. And I think, in our view, that makes it a logical starting place to try and build. When we looked at this set of issues, we felt that there were really two key missing pieces, at a minimum, that are hampering our ability as a nation to respond to a catastrophic event. And that is, first, the lack of regional planning, training, and exercising. There's a lot of activity that happens at the state level. There's activity that happens at the federal level, but there is not nearly the same level of attention at the regional level, and I think we saw in Hurricane Katrina how that hurt our response effort. And another missing piece in our view, and this is certainly an area where we take a different view than the department, there's also a lack of forces who are truly focused on this mission all the time, who build relationships with the various state and local players, with all of the different federal interagency players, and who are guaranteed to be there on short notice with their equipment, with training to do civil support missions. We think that that is required, given that many catastrophic events will not have any warning. They could involve WMD. And in our view, those operational challenges are significant enough to merit having forces that are really focused on the civil support mission. So what we're recommending is to create regional civil support forces, one in each of the 10 FEMA regions, that would be comprised of really two elements: a headquarters that would focus on being the central coordinator for regional planning, exercising, and training. This headquarters would basically grow on the existing state joint force headquarters that are already there in many states and are being formed in states where they don't already exist. So it's not creating a new headquarters. Complementing the headquarters would actually be operational forces, in many cases coming out of combat service support and combat support forces, things like transportation units, engineers, military police. And essentially, the civil support force would be comprised virtually of these types of units that would be drawn from the state guards in each of the 10 FEMA regions. During peacetime, they would report to their state governors, as they always do, but if an event happened, they would be available to deploy and be chopped to, if you will, whatever governor is most significantly under attack. Or if the president chose to federalize the response, the National Guard and the regional civil support force would fall under the command of NORTHCOM. So it's flexible in terms of the command and control arrangements. The last thing I'll say about this, and I'm happy to take more questions on it in the Q&A session, is that we think that an innovation of this recommendation is that it allows you to have a more dedicated, more focused set of forces available for civil support without taking the National Guard and focusing it only on Homeland Defense. It's not taking any units and making them permanently focused on civil support, because essentially we would be drawing on units in the third year of the R4-Gen cycle, so that once they finish that third year focusing on Homeland Defense, they would continue through the cycle and be available to deploy overseas. And as a result of the fact of that, you don't have to have a rotation base, and so it won't negatively affect the department's ability to meet its requirements overseas. Okay, enough on Homeland Defense. I'll just wrap up with a couple of our recommendations on social compact issues. In the area of recruiting, we make several recommendations, but I'll just name a few of them. First, we think it would be very useful if the reserve components offered a two-year protection for folks with prior service who are coming out of the active military to shield them from deployment. That's such a key part of the recruiting pool. And right now, it appears that some folks who might otherwise join the reserve component are not joining because they don't want to be deployed when they've just been deployed on the active side. We, in a similar way, would like to see the department go after the college market more effectively. And to do this, we think it would be useful to shield college students from deployment while they are in school in exchange for a longer service obligation. Another recommendation we have in the recruiting department is to offer accelerated citizenship for members of the reserve component, all members of the reserve component, who already have permanent residency status. We think that would enhance our recruiting efforts. On the retention side, one key thing, and I think certainly DOD recognizes and is working on this, we think it's critical to try and limit the length of mobilizations to a year or less, to include, if at all possible, any time needed for post-mobilization training and the demobilization process. These very long tours are eroding family and employer support for the reserve component. We really think limiting those tours to 1 year would be helpful. Finally, another recommendation in the retention area is the notion of making educational benefits that are available to RC members transferable to spouses to try and deepen the spousal stake in staying in the reserve component. We think that would help shore up spousal support, which is really key for retention. Looking at the continuum of service, in our view, the department needs very much a more flexible way to bring RC members onto active duty, to access them more easily, to just accomplish the transitions between the AC and the RC and allow people to serve in different ways. Fundamental to this is the need to have integrated AC and RC pay and personnel systems. We recommend essentially abandoning dimers at this point and focusing on trying to develop integrated systems at the service level. The Marines have already done this. The Navy, I think, is looking very carefully at the Marine system, and we'd like to see each of the services just focus on trying to accomplish that within their own service. We also think the idea, OSD calls it the variable participation of reserves at the unit level. The Army calls it the intensive reserve. This notion of having contracts with members of the reserve component who are willing to serve more than the 1-in-6 model, or who are willing to serve longer tours or with less notice, that it, we think it makes perfect sense to try and take advantage of folks who are willing to go above and beyond in that manner. We endorse this concept, and we would actually favor offering people willing to sign those contracts. We would see offering them additional compensation to reflect their enhanced level of service. The last couple of recommendations I want to highlight here on the social compact are healthcare and retirement. As you all know, Congress has already broadened the healthcare benefit for the reserve component substantially in the last few years. And in our view, we'd like to see Congress hold the line on further expansions of that benefit until the department can do more cost-benefit analysis to see whether further expansions of that benefit actually provide significant enhancements in terms of medical readiness or in terms of recruiting and retention. Right now, in our view, the expansions of benefits have outpaced the data that show that that is a cost-effective investment. Similarly, on the retirement system, there's been much consideration and thought about whether to lower the retirement age. The data that we looked at indicated that lowering the age from 60 to 55 would actually hurt retention, would probably reduce the reserve component's ability to retain people towards the end of their careers where they have a tremendous amount of experience. And again, obviously, enhancing the retirement program by lowering the eligibility age would be very expensive for DOD. And so in general, we were guided in part by the principle of the social compact is really three elements. On the one hand, it's compensation and benefits, but it's also providing the training for reserve component members to do their jobs and providing the equipment to them to be able to do their jobs. And every dollar you invest on the compensation and benefit side is a dollar you're not investing on the equipment and training side. So we would very much like to see the retirement plan and the healthcare plan stay where it is now and see those dollars invested instead on the equipment and training side, where in our view there are glaring shortfalls. With that, I will stop here and take questions. And certainly, if you don't have a question and you just have comments, we would welcome that. Yes. Absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up. I think in our view, the way we see, we certainly recognize the need to have a strategic reserve. And I think the way we see that happening is, on the one hand, you have, let's focus on the new 1-in-6-year rotational model. In our view, all of those forces who are in any year other than the sixth year, whether it's the first year or the sixth year, the deployment year, forces who are in something other than the actual deployment year, in our view, are available as a strategic reserve, in the sense that if we were to have to go to full mobilization, certainly you would leverage those forces. You then have the forces that are in the box, if you will, to go overseas or to perform a mission here at home. That is the part of the reserve component serving as part of the operational force. And then I think we would say that on top of that, you have this group of people who have said that they can serve above and beyond the 1-in-6 model, the intensive reserve model, as the Army calls it. That would be, you know, an additional sort of augmentation to the folks who are in the box. So we see very much the ability right now to maintain the strategic reserve. What's new in our minds and is much needed is this way of managing the operational part of the reserve component.
I understand what you just said with regards to the time frames.
Mm-hmm.
And how those that have just been are now your strategic reserve. But from my experience in the Navy side of this business, there's different missions involved in a strategic reserve and an operational reserve. I mean, we're using them in a different way. We're abandoning some of the strategic force that we've had in order to transition to a Navy reserve that does different things in the addresses that issue. You've got to train and equip for a different mission.
Well, as we understand it, I mean, I think part of moving to the operational force model is in part a departure from this idea that you will always know years in advance what mission you're training for. I mean, I think built into this is the notion that people will need to be available for a range of different missions, and as you move through the system and get closer to, quote, being in the box, you will get more clarity on what type of mission you're going to be performing. So that is a bit of a departure, but again, I don't think we see that as problematic. Yes. Good to see you.
I read your report there, and I appreciate your concern about the employer aspect of this, but I'd like to ask, because I didn't see it in there, have you considered anything that we need to do to enhance this partnership as we share manpower assets with the employers of America and Department of Defense? Have you come up with any thoughts or ideas about how we keep these partners satisfied, other than the fact that we're providing them a free enterprise system in which to operate?
Yes. Two comments I would say on that, and feel free, everyone else, to pipe up. One, the single biggest issue we heard when we talked to employers or employer groups was predictability, was this idea of we can support people being members of the reserve component. We can support people being gone even for longer periods of time. We just need to know when they're going to be gone and if possible, how long they're going to be gone so we can plan to deal with that. And I think in our view, if the transition to this rotational model is achieved successfully, that will go a long way towards providing that kind of predictability. Now, above and beyond that, we do recommend that DOD be more proactive in terms of reaching out to employers and employer groups and trying to communicate with them about essentially what they're planning in terms of the rotation pool. I think in our view, historically, DOD has not always been as communicative with the employer community about what they see as sort of being on the docket for that year and what units in what locations might be effective. So we are encouraging DOD to try and reach out more to employers and talk directly to them and say, here's what we think we're going to need. Here are the units that we think are potentially going to be deployed, and hence you all should perhaps try, you know, you employers should factor that in as you think about who may be here or who may be gone.
Christine, if you look at any of the other countries like Great Britain, Australia, Canada, that have got compensation packages for the employers, and have any ideas or recommendations along those lines of what we as a country should do?
We did look at that. And we looked at the issue of, you know, would tax incentives be helpful, et cetera. But again, in general, what we heard from employers was far more the desire to have predictability than it was the desire to have tax incentives or other financial forms of compensation or forms of support. Anyone else? Any comments? Hi. Hi, Penny. We did look at certainly the types of units that were needed, and we do recognize that a lot of the types of forces that would be most useful are in the reserves. We didn't ultimately come down, obviously, with a recommendation to rebalance from the Guard into the reserves, although we did look at those types of issues. I think what we do think would be very useful is to leverage the fact that the reserve components people tend to focus, obviously, on the National Guard a lot of time when they talk about Homeland Defense for a variety of reasons. But we recognize that the other reserves are also, quote, forward deployed around the country. And the Army Reserve, for example, has regional readiness commands that are already aligned with the FEMA regions. And so we do say, when we go into detail in that section of the report, that these civil support forces should work with, for example, the other reserve components, and we do specifically highlight the Army Reserve, and try and draw on those capabilities. Frankly, ultimately, I think we think it would be very useful to have a database, and this really, I think, should be something that NORTHCOM takes on, that includes a map, essentially, of where all the different units in the reserve component are in the country that could be leveraged in a response effort, so that we would know where things are, who's in charge of them, and how they would fit in. And certainly that's an area, I think, where we would want to leverage the reserves as opposed to the Guard heavily. To my knowledge, this type of database doesn't yet exist, but we absolutely see the reserves as a key partner, and we think more needs to be done to, again, try and understand what's out there and to build relationships and figure out how to bring people together. I think one challenge, and we didn't recommend this in the report, but I think it's something worth looking into seriously. As we understand it, the reserves cannot be involuntarily mobilized for domestic missions. So that to the extent, for example, the reserves participated in the response to Hurricane Katrina, it was on strictly a volunteer basis. I think it would facilitate the ability to leverage the reserves if they could be involuntarily mobilized, because obviously during a crisis, you may not have the time to sort of figure out who can volunteer and where those volunteers are. So I think it would be useful if Congress looked into whether it made sense to change that. Yes.
Gordon Adams, George Washington University. Two questions for Steve. One's with relation to mission, and the other with relation to costs. On the mission side, you build in an assumption here, understandably, that there's some external outside the United States mission requirement that's going to drive a very high level of Army Force structure in general and the reserves component for operational purposes as well. Can you give us any details on what you think the external mission is and that is driving that requirement? We obviously have one. We've been articulate about the domestic mission. The international mission we have that we can count right now is the major that required to rotate forces in Iraq and in general with respect to operations against terrorism. Do you expect that to be continue to be a driver if one were not deployed in Iraq? What would be the force driver that would require this larger force, and how would it drive the Guard? So that's one set of questions. The other is you've got some cost estimates in there with respect to the modularity and equipping and reset issues of $13 billion. There are also some recommendations in there on the social side, the expansion, for example, of higher education benefits to spouses and reservists and so on. Have you done any cost estimating for the whole package in the report, or is the only cost estimate you have so far that modularity reset?
I'll take the second question just because it's a little bit briefer. No, we do not have. We did not do detailed costing of our recommendations. I think it's not on the specific issue of expand or making education benefits transferable. Difficult to cost that out just because we don't know how many spouses would take advantage of that benefit were it to exist. And frankly, right now, people don't fully take advantage in some cases of the educational benefit. So doing the costing on that would be challenging. We have, as you can see, a fairly small study team, and we also, as an outside panel, didn't have extensive access to cost data, inside of the department. I think, in general, I would argue that the most costly recommendations that we make are the ones that we did attach a price tag to. Clearly, expanding the size of the Army, I mean, we do note that it obviously would be most desirable to achieve additional combat structure from within existing end strength by trying to pursue the traditional holy grail of Department of Defense, do things more effectively, defense reform initiative, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think we're particularly optimistic about the ability to achieve an additional 4 to 5 BCTs within existing end strength through those means. Obviously, there would be a substantial price tag attached to that. Many of the other recommendations, frankly, we don't necessarily see as being highly costly. They're really much more organizational or cultural changes. But in short, we do not have a sort of uber price tag for all 43 recommendations. Turning to the issue of the mission in the future and what we believe is driving demand. This is something that Clark and Michelle, we had very active debates about early in our study. And I think in our view, even if we draw down troops in Iraq in particular in the future, we believe that we will continue to have substantial numbers of forces in Iraq for some years to come. And I think if you look at the profile of stability and reconstruction operations in the last decade, it generally takes us longer to get out of places that we've gone into than we plan. So I think we think that could, we certainly don't think we'll see the need to have 16 to 20 brigades in Iraq, but I think we think that 10 to 12 could be there for some time with Iraq and Afghanistan together. I think then when you start looking at other missions overseas, the general counterterrorism, war on terror requirements, things, operations in the Horn of Africa, legacy peacekeeping operations in the former Yugoslavia. There are some forces tied down in Guantanamo, you know, unclear how much longer that will be the case, but it's just unclear. And then, so those are all operations that we see as known today that are likely to continue for some time. And then again, I think in our view, we need to have forces available. I mean, we also have forces. There's one brigade still in Europe. We've got ground forces in Korea, in part for things like reassurance and deterrence, those good old traditional missions. But we also think there need to be forces available, ready forces available to respond to unforeseen events. Something like if President Musharraf were assassinated in Pakistan, if we were to have military operations on the Korean Peninsula. And again, we would argue we need to have ready forces available to respond to a catastrophic event here at home. And that could be, you know, a substantial requirement were it to happen, particularly if it were a WMD event. So I think we do feel that there are substantial requirements, both known and unforeseen, for which DOD has to be prepared, that argue for a slightly larger ground force.
Please. If I could just add, on that point, I mean, I think, you know, if you look at the current defense strategy, which actually has a fair number of elements of continuity, you know, particularly that as a global power with global interests, the United States has to be able to do more than one major operation at a time, you know. And so if you look at sort of two major operations, whether it's wars or large stability operations, you also look at the sort of underlying steady state deployments that will be required for a long war dealing with whether it's terrorism, counterinsurgency, and so forth. You get up to a very high level of demand very quickly. You know, if you want to be prepared to maintain that steady state and conduct two large operations of one type or another at the same time, particularly if they're of any length or duration, where you start having to have a rotation base and so forth. So we really didn't believe that we were. You know, we looked at some alternative levels of demand, and we sort of took the middle case, not the highest case that we could imagine. But on your question of cost, the other thing I just wanted to highlight that's sort of implicit throughout the report, but we didn't make explicit this morning, and that is that what we are recommending here will require a greater level of investment by the active duty components in terms of personnel engaged with the reserve components. I mean, really making the reserve components more operational will require a personnel investment in terms of people working with the reserves on training, on revitalizing the IRR to make that viable in many services and so forth. So in addition to the dollar cost, I just wanted to highlight there is a personnel focus, attention, energy cost that is really important. And if we don't pay that, we won't make it to the goal of a viable operational reserve.
I would like to comment on this as well, since I was the member of the team that probably argued most strongly for the position that while it took us 30 years to unlearn no more Vietnams, that it'll take us another 30 years to unlearn no more Iraqs. I was persuaded that my argument was Luddite for two reasons, essentially. One is that right now we're fighting a two-country global war on terrorism because of the concentration of all of our resources in Afghanistan and Iraq. It is a global war, and we're not deployed that way. So there will be a demand that's going to come in as soon as forces are released. The second one is that unlike in the past when we sized our forces for conventional operations, in this war of irregular warfare, it's all about rotation base and sustaining the steady state requirements. One of the big innovations in my mind of the QDR is the adoption of thinking about steady state and surge requirements, because it's a steady state requirement that requires a rotation base to sustain it. And it's the rotation that's eating our lunch in Afghanistan, Iraq, and we really don't know what a sustainable rotation looks like in the long term. The assumptions now are 1 in 3 for the active, 1 in 4 for the reserves, and 1 in 5 for the Guard. We don't know if that's really it or not. So I became persuaded that because of the rotation nature, need to hedge about the uncertainty on that, that the demand is going to remain high. Well, the other point I wanted to make is that when Christine described the text as gripping, I prefer the term riveting.
Yes.
Dave Woodball, one of the most riveting of your recommendations, I thought, was that the president, urging the president to issue a call to national service. And I wonder if you looked at the Guard as a mechanism to draw the participation of a greater portion of Americans into the war of terrorism, or did you reject that because the Guard can't handle it?
It's buried in the report, but I do think it's one of our most important recommendations. We are in a long war, but we have not really mobilized the American people for that war at this point. And we feel that it's also related to recruiting and retention. The U.S. military needs more political top cover in asking people to serve. We're not talking about a draft. Let me repeat, we are not talking about a draft. We are talking about a call to voluntary service. That may be active duty for some people. It may be reserve duty for others. It may be some other form of public service. But one of the themes of this report is that we need our political leaders, particularly the president, but others as well, to really call Americans to serve, to draw on the diversity, the richness, the talents of our country more fully than we are today, and to also create more opportunities for service. That's part of the continuum of service idea, is to say you don't have to fit in this, you know, 1 week in a month, 2 weeks a year box anymore. Now there are a whole range of opportunities, mixing active and reserve service over a period of time, different kinds of reserve service. There are pilot programs that are expanding with this concept. We want to see those much greatly expanded and much more fully realized. So I think it's the reserves play, and this, I say this as a wife of a reservist, the reserves play a very vital function linking the U.S. military, which has become increasingly small and professional, to the American people. And that link is critical to our democracy. And I think the more we can strengthen that link, the better. Yes.
Thank you.
we certainly don't think that it's all going to be accomplished overnight. I would say a couple of things. One, I think some of the, to use your word, tactical recommendations in the area of personnel and recruiting and retention, some of those are already ongoing or have begun in DOD, and we are in part trying to provide, you know, reinforcing fire to try and support DOD's efforts to fully realize the vision of a lot of those recommendations, things like the continuum of service. You know, I think those, all of those more detailed recommendations are important. And in part, I think one of the challenges of conducting this study is it's hard to separate out things and compartmentalize them because they're so interrelated. I mean, I would argue that making the transition to using the reserve component as an operational force successful is one of the most important, highest priority recommendations we have. But wrapped up in that are the issues of the equipment funding, the issues of the training program. But if you don't have the people to flesh out that model, then you don't. It doesn't matter whether you have all of the resources there for the equipment. So that's where the recruiting and retention recommendations become important, even if they're much more detailed. You know, without a successful recruiting and retention program, you don't have a fully populated reserve component to use. So that certainly, I think, is one important priority. Speaking to your comment about the Homeland Defense issue, I think, you know, we would argue that the 1421 construct, I think, you know, which is evolving, shall we say, through this new QDR, our fundamental point is the one is really currently largely rhetorical as opposed to being backed up by forces, programs, plans, policies. And that's what we would like to see change. Now, another challenge we had taking on this study, which anyone looking at these issues has, is the fact that the whole landscape of where does DOD fit in terms of Homeland Security, Homeland Defense, is changing. That was true when we started the study in January of 2005. It was much more true after Hurricane Katrina and the president's comments that perhaps DOD needed to play a larger role. So, you know, it's hard to make recommendations about a subset of the issue when the whole landscape is moving underneath you. You know, but I think in our view, even if all of the details sort of at the global level in terms of the relationship of DOD to DHS have not been sorted out, we still feel that it's clear that the reserve component is going to be a key asset and right now is underutilized in that area. Terry. First of all, you know, I've heard enough the whole I'm a simple country boy thing. That's been some of the smartest men that I know in the Pentagon give you that line. So I'm not falling for that. We feel strongly that it is not necessary and would actually be counterproductive to elevate the chief of the National Guard Bureau to a 4-star for the following reasons. I think in our view, the inherent structure of the National Guard being based in the 54 states and territories, the relationship that the Guard has with the governors, gives the National Guard a very influential and significant voice on the back end of the policy and budget process on Capitol Hill. So any Secretary of Defense, Deputy Secretary, Secretary of the Army, Chief of Staff of the Army worth his or her salt understands that if there's a difficult issue that needs to be addressed with the National Guard, that it behooves them to deal with those issues inside during the internal process and try and resolve it there. Because if they don't resolve it there, they will have to resolve it on Capitol Hill, where they will have far less control over the process. So I think we would argue that the mechanisms are already there to try and address, and the incentives are already there to try and address difficult problems internally. And I think we would argue that the incentives to address these difficult issues internally have actually grown because of the fact that now the reserve component, the Army in particular, is being used much more as an operational force, and that really the active and the reserve components are partnered at the hip, and it's in both parties' self-interest to try and do right by each other. That's the positive reason I think we would argue that it's not necessary. If you want to focus on the negative side, our concern about elevating the chief of the Guard Bureau to a four-star level is that it would probably send the signal to many that the Guard is a separate service, when in fact, 9 times out of 10, it is part of the Federal Army and the Federal Air Force. And is an integral part of those two services, and hence there is already representation. We don't want to create the sense that it's a fifth or sixth service when, in fact, it's part of the Army and the Air Force. Does any of my other colleagues want to comment on that?
Yes, I'd like to add something to that, but from a different perspective. We don't need more four stars. We need fewer four stars. We really only need... We really only need a four-star at each of the combatant commands and at the head of each service. Everybody else should be a three-star and below. Think how much easier that would make everybody's life in terms of trying to get anything done. And if I'm quoted on that, please note the applause throughout the audience at that suggestion.
PJ.
PJ Crowley, Senate from American Progress. Just need two questions for the panel. On command relationships, your command civil support headquarters, how do they intersect with the existing EMAP system on guard deployments and emergencies? And then, you know, it just came out of the White House post-between the report. How do you describe the relationship between NORTHCOM and
Right. First, I'll talk a little bit about how we see the regional civil support forces working in terms of the EMAC process. I think we think the CSFs would be very compatible with EMAC, and really what we're trying to address is our understanding is that EMAC has provided a mechanism to try and do some coordination at the regional level or has been the mechanism during an event to actually share forces. But what we're really looking for is much more regional coordination and planning sort of as a preparedness function, you know, in peacetime, if you will, which really isn't happening at least comprehensively or on a standardized basis through EMAC. But it's very much sort of using the EMAC idea. In terms of command and control, in our view, if you had these civil support forces and something were to happen, state governors would still retain the ability to make the decision as to whether, you know, they wanted to deploy whichever piece of the operational civil support force they happen to own to a governor of another state who is in trouble. We would hope that as part of the planning process, they would figure out how to free up that particular unit and still have enough in reserve to deal with their own issues or if there were another terrorist attack that they were concerned about. But it's not trying to take control away from the governors. And in fact, I think we are trying to reinforce the idea that in many cases we firmly believe that responses will be commanded and controlled by governors more often than not. while we certainly recognize there are some scenarios where you may want to actually go to a federalized model. In terms of the relationship of the Guard and NORTHCOM and NGB, we firmly believe that we do not want to, we do not see the Guard and NORTHCOM as competitors. We would like to see the Guard and NORTHCOM work together. And that is partly why we recommended that the deputy commander of NORTHCOM be a Guard general officer, because we think that would speed up and increase the integration of the Guard and NORTHCOM. We don't necessarily think that that relationship would need to be there ad infinitum. It may be that 10 years from now, the NORTHCOM is and the Guard are sufficiently comfortable with each other that that's no longer necessary. But right now, we think that would be sort of a confidence-building measure. Getting to the NGB side of things, I think in our view, we did not use the phrase force provider because that implies that the NGB would have responsibility for organized training and equipping, and that's, of course, the responsibility of the state governors and the adjutant generals. We use the word force manager because I think we do believe that NGB played and will play an important role in terms of coordinating the various groups of Guard that individual states can offer up. So force provider, we're not technically comfortable with that word, but certainly NGB, I think, does play an important coordinating role. We explored the idea, and frankly, we just weren't able to flesh it out far enough to include it in the report. But I personally am at least attracted to the idea of thinking about NGB potentially as a maybe a dual-hatted component command to NORTHCOM in the sense that when NORTHCOM needs to get input from a planning perspective about what Guard capabilities are or how they might fit into the deliberate planning process, being able to go to NGB as sort of the one-stop shop for that advice and counsel, I think may make sense. But again, because of sort of the unique animal that is NGB and the fact that it doesn't own forces, it's a little bit sticky to sort of think of it as a component command the way you think of traditional component commands. Charlie. That's an important issue, and I think it is more challenging, frankly, because of the fact that the reserves don't have the same political structure that the Guard has. And I think the, my hope for optimism on this front is the fact that I believe we have entered a new era of using the reserves as part of the operational force. And I like to end these briefings usually by saying that, in my mind, you know, the health, as goes the health of the reserve component, so goes the health of the all-volunteer force. You know, I would like to think that because the reserves are such an important part right now of the operational force, that the active side has a self-interest in a way that it did not have before in making sure that the reserves are properly resourced. So to the extent that that paradigm shift is beginning to happen, I think there is some cause for optimism that we may see reserve component interests better represented inside the department. But I do think it is true that organizationally there isn't as good a fix for the reserves as there is for the Guard. And I think, you know, that for all of us who are interested in these issues and pay attention to these issues, it's our responsibility to try and continue to draw attention to them and to help the reserves get that attention that they need. You in the back?
I
Let me speak to that issue and give my view. One, I think in all fairness to the Army, we have to recognize that the Army is under tremendous fiscal pressure. And I think, you know, the decisions that were made in the wake of the QDR, it wasn't, to my view, it was not a case of the Army simply saying, let's stiff the Army Guard and reserves just because we have cultural issues and just because they're not the active component. I think the Army was facing very difficult financial challenges and was having to make some very difficult choices. And, you know, the issue of bringing the Guard fully inside of that decision internally or letting it wait and having it play out on Capitol Hill as it has, there really weren't a lot of great choices between those two alternatives, frankly. Well, I think you see some instances where that phenomenon has taken place, and I think you see other instances where that phenomenon has been much better managed. I mean, I think, for example, the Army did a much better job with the National Guard during the BRAC process, for example, than the Air Force did. So I think there was a recognition in that instance that it was important to bring the Guard inside the tent, if you will, throughout the whole process. So I don't think it's fair to say that every single time there is a difficult issue, the Army always stiffs the Guard. And again, I believe that this growing partnership is going to create greater incentives to address some of this. I mean, I think in our view, we're not saying that we think from here forward that every Secretary of the Army and every Secretary of Defense will make the decision to handle every difficult issue internally from the very beginning throughout the process. I think those, you know, things will happen on a case-by-case basis. But what we are saying is the structural fix of making the Chief of NGB a four-star, you know, and or giving him or her a seat at the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the downsides of that, in our mind, outweigh the potential benefits. And we're simply not convinced that the benefits are necessarily what some argue that they would be. You know, it's not clear to me at all that adding a star necessarily will elevate the voice of the Guard at the table. Bob.
Yeah, Bob Bolish. I don't have a job. did you hear at all bubbling up anything about the role of Special Operations Forces in the Guard and Reserve? I don't, since I was only on one working group, the Social Compact, and that didn't deal with force structure missions, but the entire SOC community is currently rent by those incredibly deep debates about its relationship with the active force, its relationship with the SecDef, with everything else in the armed forces. And I'm wondering what you heard about this. Did you think about including something in the report, and or if not, what did you hear anyway?
Two comments I would make on that, and again, I welcome any comments from my colleagues. One, I think we looked at the pieces of the reserve component, the special forces pieces of it during our roles and missions discussions, and I think, you know, we view, you know, obviously when special forces are in such great demand, it's critical to maintain those units that we have in the reserve component that are special forces. And so, you know, that was, again, part of what we were talking about when we said it's important to have a multi-mission capable reserve component. Though to the extent that you can hold on to special forces capabilities that take so long to grow in the active side, to the extent that the reserve component can help you hold on to those for a longer period of time, that's very useful. The other area where the debates came up on the special forces side, to my mind, was in the specific area of civil affairs and this whole debate about the civil affairs folks in the reserves. Are they going to be under SOCOM? Are they going to be under a different part of Army Command? Will active duty civil affairs people report to a different commander than reserve component civil affairs people report to? We didn't comment on that in our report, but certainly we've come across this debate and we followed this debate, and I think you know, we don't have a firm view at this point in time, although to my mind, if people's military specialty is civil affairs, It shouldn't matter. They should report to the same commander, I'm inclined to believe, regardless of whether they're AC or RC. You know, functionally, civil affairs belong somewhere, and if you're active civil affairs or reserve civil affairs, you probably are doing the same thing and should be in the same chain of command. So that's probably an area where we heard the most about it, but we didn't have a recommendation in that area.
I could just add, by way of advertisement, we did hear a lot about these issues, we did not deal with them in this report, but we are going to deal with them. Clark and I are co-directing a new project at CSIS called the Project on Special Operations Forces, which is was launching now. We'll have our first big annual conference in the fall. This is one of the issues that we will be grappling with, among many others, including roles and missions, organizations, command relationships. How do you maintain culture amidst rapid growth? You know, all of those complex issues with regard to SOF. So we're aware of it. We didn't put out anything definitive here, but we do hope to address that in work that's underway.
Why don't I take just a couple more questions? Dave. In my mind, border security is not a mission I want to see permanently on the plate of the National Guard. Because we have a Customs and Border Patrol. I mean, I think it's a mission that the Guard is fully capable of executing, but there's another federal agency who has that responsibility. And I think what we would like to see is that if the Guard is going to get involved in border security, again, speaking for myself, it should be in a crisis management mode, somewhat similar to what happened after 9/11, where we sent the Guard to the airports temporarily while we brought private security online. As a gap-filling measure, I think it's okay. I think part of the reason you don't want to see it become a permanent steady state mission is because of what I believe you're seeing right now, which is that the president, I think for understandable reasons, doesn't want to involuntarily mobilize guardsmen and women to do border security because there's sort of a political threshold you have to cross to call people up under Title 10. But because he is hence driven to relying on volunteers, it's challenging to find volunteers in sufficient numbers who can go down there to the border, particularly when they're doing it on very short tours. I mean, there's going to be a lot of sort of churning to maintain 6,000 for any lengthy period of time. So I think those types of challenges are reasons why I would argue that this is, you know, we did not highlight border security as a crucial new emerging mission for the Guard for this reason. I think we would see it consistent as part of a response, again, to a terrorist attack as a crisis management measure, but not something steady state. Yes.
What we tried to do in general in the personnel side, but specifically in healthcare, was separate out anecdote from evidence and encourage the department to support policy changes that are based on evidence. And you'll see when you read the report that we recognize that there's a political impetus on Capitol Hill to do things for the reserves, things being not necessarily defined or supported by evidence. Our recommendations are basically along the line that before we further expand or before anyone further expands the health care benefit, we should take the time to ensure that such expansion meets the intended goal and is cost-effective for the country. So our thoughts are more that we should have well-intentioned and well-supported policies as just opposed to policies that might be important today but not really provide the department the long-run benefit that it should have.
And following up on that, I would say something, you know, regardless of whether you agree with where we came down on healthcare or retirement, I think anyone who cares about these issues, one of our recommendations was that the department start collecting longitudinal data across the full spectrum of these issues, how people feel, you know, healthcare, recruiting, retention, you name it. One challenge we found as we were taking on this study was that there simply isn't a lot of longitudinal data that allows you to look at these things over time in a supportable way. So regardless of whether you agree where we came out, I think all of us should encourage DOD to start collecting data consistently and reliably from year to year to enable us to make informed policy decisions as opposed to being much more reactive, which is where DOD is today. With that, we've kept everyone a little bit longer than an hour. We so much appreciate your attention and interest in this topic. Please pick up a copy of the report if you haven't already, and thank you so much for coming.